Welcome to the WBCO Journal. I'm Andrew Meyer. Whether it's a matter of manpower or leadership, a problem that's new or systemic, the city of Paterson is struggling to help its neediest residents keep a roof over their heads.
I do stand by and support my director and my directors. And if they don't do what is expected, then I deal with them accordingly.
On tonight's show, what needs to be done to fix Paterson's Department of Community Development. Also tonight, the transformation of urban America through the lens of Newark after Cory Booker.
I am very interested to see what is going to happen right now for the city of Newark.
Crime pays in New York, at least on stage, and we welcome the return of a holiday classic. All that straight ahead on tonight's WBCO Journal. Stay tuned. The supply of affordable housing in Paterson is at an all-time low. There are currently 750 families on the city's waiting list for public housing. As Paterson struggles to deal with this crisis, the department charged with administering the funds for various housing programs is in the midst of a crisis of its own. WBCO investigative reporter Cindy Waitman has the story.
When it comes to housing projects, there's one department that rules them all in Paterson. That would be the Department of Community Development. Its mission is to steer millions of dollars from the federal and state government to local nonprofits and residents. However, after a series of missteps, there's growing concern that the woman in charge of the department, Lanisha Mackle, is not up to the job. Councilman Anthony Davis, speaking at a community forum in the city's North Ward, says her inexperience is a problem.
I have been frustrated with community development for some time now. I gave the mayor the benefit of the doubt in terms of allowing, you know, to pick his candidates who he wished to run administration, and that's what he did.
Lanisha Mackle has served as Director of Community Development for the last 3 years. Mackle's professional background includes 4 years as Director of the Workforce Investment Board of Passaic County, a board that oversees grants for workforce training. Prior to that, she served in lower-level administrative positions in private schools. Mackle and her staff told me more than once that she does not do interviews. She did finally agree to speak with me after I reached out to Mayor Jeffrey Jones. However, she continued to push our face-to-face meeting back until finally I caught up with her on a cell phone. When it comes to meeting deadlines and goals, Mackle herself admits that her department falls short, but she blames many of the city's problems on a manpower shortage caused by recent layoffs.
I think that the city is on track to meet its goals and objectives for its action plan and consolidated plan. However, there is not enough money available for us to meet all of our goals. The city needs more resources.
Mackle and her department most recently came under scrutiny in late September. That's when it was revealed that Paterson was in danger of losing out on $650,000 of HUD home funds from program year 2011 because of a looming deadline to commit the funds. This is federal money with few strings attached. The city just made it, allocating the money to a local nonprofit for a 12-unit affordable housing project. It was a close call, but Mayor Jeffrey Jones insists that the problem is not with his administration. He blames the recession and the fact that banks stopped lending money to local community development organizations.
They go out and then they say to their funder, I got the city's portion, the commitment from the city in the form of a letter, and I want my loan now. And in many cases, the bank said no, or whatever. So that then, remember the big clock that's ticking, puts us in the clock now. Because we had made a commitment. We spent 6 months, 8 months getting you prepped and ready, and now you're telling us you don't have it.
The mayor adds, many of these organizations don't have a proven track record, and that makes the banks unwilling to take a chance. Although Paterson beat the deadline for 2011, there have been other times the city hasn't been so lucky. A HUD spokesman says the city lost out last year on roughly $1.5 million. The mayor insists the problem goes way back before his administration.
The history of the city, we weren't getting things done. Funds were always being sent back. They never made the big public conversation. So there's some personal issue going on, and there's no doubt, and some politics. But these problems have always been the case. They go back as far as 30 years. We have records to prove it. Funds have always been sent back.
The recession may only be part of the problem with the department. Councilman Anthony Davis says the manpower shortage has been caused by Mackle's management style, which has led to lawsuits against the city and Mackle herself.
She's overwhelmed, and the staff is not there. We've never had any department where we had staff members that is retaliating and want to sue, you know, because of whatever reason. I don't know. But not putting them on it right now, the job is not being done.
Mackle denies that the pending lawsuits have anything to do with the staffing problem.
It has nothing to do with there being a staffing shortage in the city. The city did a layoff a while ago, and, you know, this department just is not up to its staffing levels, period.
The troubles with community development have been well documented in an annual report that the department produces for HUD. The most recent consolidated annual performance and evaluation report found that a staffing shortage creates a state of emergency within the department. HUD had previously audited the department and found a lack of technical know-how among staff and a backlog of open projects. Another area that has Patterson residents concerned is the city's plans to buy out homes in the flood-prone North Ward. The city was awarded $5.7 million in FEMA funds in 2011 to buy out 30 homes following Hurricane Irene. The lack of communication has led residents to fear that the money for buyouts will also be put into jeopardy. Mayor Jeffrey Jones admits those fears may not be unfounded.
They have to go through these stringent processes, getting an assessment of the property's value. If they had already been paid out because of past flooding, they're going to get less. And they're holding on to the notion that their homes are worth more. Understood. But we have a clock now. Mm-hmm. And if we don't move that, we're back to the same conversation.
FEMA says these buyout funds are not at risk as of yet. The city has until March 2015 to get it done. Still, community leaders, including Reverend James Staten of North Ward Community Development, remain wary. A number of homeowners who are pursuing the buyouts are on hold because of an environmental review that's part of the process. And Reverend Staten says it's all Lanisha Mackle's fault.
The city council gave her a vote of no confidence, and that's our legislative piece. So until I see otherwise or shown otherwise, then I have to go with what I see. Right now, the council seemed to be right on point with what their decision was.
One more area of concern is abandoned properties. Celeste Kuchera lives in the North Ward, and she says the people that are breaking into those properties are creating a dangerous element in the community.
Way worse. I come from school, and they're, like, in the houses, taking the aluminum, or just living in those houses, and nobody knows because it's dangerous, and they come in the night sometimes. And nobody knows who's in their houses or anything. It's, like, the homeless people in their in those houses.
It's up to the Department of Public Works to board up the homes. DPW Director Chris Koch says the city does what it can, but there's just too many of them.
There is a backlog. On some days it seems like we're catching up some weeks. We're catching up, and then no sooner than that we can, you know, be hit with a barrage of, you know, five or six properties that we have to board up in a day.
The city does have tools in place to help combat the problem, but it's the Community Development Department that decides which homes the city will target for rehabilitation or demolition. Lanisha Mackle says the city investigates the properties every 6 months. By contrast, Jersey City does this every 45 days. Patterson Mayor Jeffrey Jones says Mackle inherited a poorly run department, and it's the existing staff that were unqualified for the job. Despite the many shortcomings in community development, he is standing by his director.
It could be for any number of reasons that people have a position. It's not for me to judge. I don't. But I do stand by and support my director and my directors. And if they don't do what is expected, then I deal with them accordingly. And so at this juncture, that hasn't been an issue. So I have nothing to offer on that conversation.
While Jones defends his appointee, the council is advancing a resolution to hire a consultant to help Mackle with her duties. One thing Jones and the council can agree on, Mackle needs more staff, and that may soon be dealt with. The mayor says the state, which must approve all hiring for the city, has given the okay to add more personnel to Patterson's Department of Community Development. For the WBGO Journal, I'm Cindy Waitman in Patterson. Thank you.
local political science and history professor, has spent the last dozen years looking at Newark's political landscape, past and present. He's now out with a book about it and sat down this week with WBGO's Doug Doyle.
Joining us on the WBGO Journal is Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and History at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken. Professor Wharton is out with a new book, A Post-Racial Change is Gonna Come, Newark, Cory Booker, and the Transformation of Urban America. Professor Wharton, good to see you.
Good seeing you too, Doug. Thank you.
You've been a longtime friend of WBGO. This book covers the whole era, really, of Cory Booker's administration, and you go into the history of Newark. You're a former resident of Newark. You spent time in Brick City.
Exactly.
What did you learn as you started to dip into the history of Mayor Adonisio and Ken Gibson and folks like that?
It was a fascinating pattern that you kind of see taking place from the 1950s, even to some degree today, that there's a lot to be said about community, local politics, how strong it is here in Newark. Certainly, as you mentioned, Doug, I've been here. You know, I lived here for about 3-4 years when I was in grad school at Rutgers, so I saw that firsthand. But going back historically to the city is amazing to see just how many years and how much power centered there in City Hall.
Most people realize that the former mayor is now U.S. Senator Cory Booker, and you spend a lot of time in your book talking about how the administration dealt with Prudential Center. It's not necessarily a glowing review of Mayor Booker. Is that a fair assessment?
I think I'm trying to give a balanced account because most of the interviews, obviously, from city council members. So some of the assessments coming directly from them with the interviews. I will admit that in the final chapter, there is some analysis there where I do bring up some serious concerns, not so much about him, but certainly the administration and how they've operated at City Hall.
I love the fact that your book is extremely current. I mean,
thank you.
You're right up to the point that people know. You include, you know, Senator Lautenberg's death and the mayor running for his seat. So how were you able to put all this together so quickly and get it out?
Well, you know, it's been a 12-year struggle. I mean, I've been following this since 2001 when I was involved with the Eagleton Institute of Politics with the voting project here in Newark. So it does go all the way up until September. And I certainly wanted to make certain to include, Senator Lautenberg's death. I think that was a significant factor in all this, especially for his running for office. Thankfully, the publisher was at least agreeable towards updating that part of it. But the one part that I'm really so much interested in this book, and I think you probably noticed, is urban development. As you mentioned, the hockey arena was a big focus of this book. I think that the deal was transformative for the city and certainly for the area.
Now that you've had a chance to look back, the deal to bring the Devils here to Prudential Center, is this something that will get better now with the new owners in charge? The Vanderbeek era was not a productive one, at least between him and the mayor, and not necessarily between the city either.
And the city council. You know, there's a lot of interest among the council members about the deal. And I think rightfully so. $210 million is an awful lot of money, at least for a city like Newark, to help out. And then ultimately, the deal that took place finally ended. It just seemed like it was an entire saga that went on for years. And it's interesting, at least in terms of how I highlight in the book, that Cory Booker was very much against the deal originally. But certainly as mayor, he changed his mind. I don't think he really had much choice in the matter since the deal was done prior to his administration. But I think that you will see some changes taking place in downtown Newark, but it's going to take a long time before you see something transformative.
One of the things that really rings true as I read your book, Professor Wharton, A Post-Racial Change is Going to Come, Newark, Cory Booker, and the Transformation of Urban America, is the fact that there has been this long-running divide between old Newark and the Cory Booker administration.
Yes.
Talk about that for our listeners.
Absolutely. I've seen that throughout, from the very beginning, going back even to 2001, just before even Cory Booker announces that he's going to run for mayor. As a council member, you saw that when he was, his first term. There were these longstanding concerns between himself and the community. And it still remains, I think, to some degree here. Now, he's argued, and he certainly told me in the interview, and I think rightfully so, that some of the people who have been against him have been the Sharp James supporters and certainly some of the old vanguard, some of the old guard here in Newark. And I think there is some issue to be brought out about that. In my interviews, certainly with the council members, they made that known. Now, according to him, according to Cory Booker at least, they're not that big of a cadre. He sees it as a smaller group. But for me, in terms of what I say in the book, it is what I call backlash coalition building that's taken place. Maybe it's not that significant of a group, some people might argue, but I still think it brought out some of the key issues here in Newark.
We're speaking here with Professor Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and History at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken. I have to ask you, now that Cory Booker is a U.S. Senator and the mayoral election coming up in May, I'm not going to ask you to, you know, support anybody or throw to talk about the individuals running, but where do you see Newark now, post-Booker?
That's something I'm very concerned with, and I think I made that known in the final chapter, because I feel as though that there's a void now. It's interesting to see at least, Councilman Quintana, at least among others, who's now obviously taking up the helm, certainly Councilman Crump being now the council president. This is an issue that I felt from the very beginning before even Senator Lautenberg died. What is going to happen in Newark right now? You're having a significant sea change in City Hall, and certainly with the recent firings, there in City Hall only a couple of weeks ago. I am very interested to see what is going to happen right now for the city of Newark. The May mayoral election is something to follow, and I'll certainly be paying attention to it. Are we going to see some of the changes that Cory Booker started? Is it going to continue on for the next generation in terms of urban development, urban renewal? Certainly, education reform and public safety still remains. These are still key issues for the next year, easily to the next 5 years. And that's what I'm interested in following.
Whether you like them or not, Sharp James and Cory Booker were both bigger than life sometimes.
Yes.
When it comes to, especially on the national scene. And, Sharp James was Newark's number one cheerleader for so long. Then Cory Booker is seen as someone on the national level that, people talked about. The next mayor of Newark, very big shoes to fill, not necessarily if you believe in what they did, but their persona.
Mm-hmm. That both mayors are huge. As a matter of fact, I argue in the book, all the mayors are big. whether it is Adonisio, whether it is Carlin, obviously Gibson, they have all been significant mayors. It's certainly at the local level. Whoever the next mayor will be has to be that continuous cheerleader for the city. And that's what I'm most interested in.
Professor Wharton, what can the next mayor of Newark learn from the administrations of James and Booker?
The fact that when it comes to bringing out the important issues for cities, they need to bring it out in a positive way. They need to get the media involved. They need to get local people involved. I think that's the one thing I really argue in the book. There needs to be at least a sea change, at least within the communities. Let's face it, Doug. You and I both know, and I think anybody here who listens to WBGO understands that communities here in Newark are very complex. They're very nuanced. You have to include them at the table. Whoever the mayor is, whoever has been the mayor, not to include the various communities that exist in the city can come back to haunt you. And I think that the great example of that is the hockey deal. I think the great example of that has been the MUA battles. Whoever has been mayor there in City Hall, even on the city council, you have to include the communities. Otherwise, it can come back to haunt you.
I know you can find it in Dr. Clement Price. From Rutgers Newark for a lot of your quotes in the book and a lot of your information. He has been saying that all along, that has been critical of Mayor Booker for not including enough people at the table.
It's no secret. Dr. Price is a great mentor of mine, former professor of mine. He's helped me out significantly with this book in what was initially a dissertation. We both agreed the same way that, whoever's been the mayor, and certainly somebody like Cory Booker, has to understand the dynamics of the local communities. I think he has made that known historically, and it's something to be said. I agree with him on that. I think the difference, though, between Professor Price and myself, though, is that I tend to spend more time on urban development. That's my big issue, because I want to see this city prosper. I think as anybody who is a fan of Newark wants to see that happen.
Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Assistant Professor of Political Science and History at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, out with his new book, A Post-Racial Change is Going to Come, Newark, Cory Booker, and the Transformation of Urban America. Thanks so much for joining us here on the WBGO Journal.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
You can check out the entire interview with Dr. Wharton at WBGONews.org.
This river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know, change has gotta come now. Ooh, yes it is.
This is the WBCO Journal. I'm Andrew Meyer. On stage in New York, there's a new show about the fallout from making a killing the Madoff way. Another about how killing can actually get you ahead in life. Our theater critic Michael Bourne says you don't want to miss either one.
Crime is played for laughs in a new musical on Broadway, A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. Crime also gets laughs, mostly ironic laughs, in a new play off Broadway, The Commons of Pensacola. Blythe Danner plays Judith, wife of a crook like Bernie Madoff, who's swindled millions from countless victims. And after all the family's money is lost in her husband's conviction, Judith is now relocated to a cheaper apartment in Pensacola and must live on the allowance she gets from government watchdogs who continue questioning how much of her husband's frauds did she know about and where's the money. Sarah Jessica Parker plays Becca, one of the daughters whose acting career seems over and whose younger boyfriend wants to turn into a reality TV show, The Mother's Struggles from Affluence to Being Penniless. Another angrier daughter and a mixed-up granddaughter show up, which complicates all of the family's questions that much more. Who knows what? Who needs what? Who's loved best? And where's the money? Amanda Peet wrote the play with sharp dialogue that to Blythe Danner gives even sharper twists. The Commons of Pensacola is playing on stage one of the Manhattan Theater Club at City Center. Crime also complicates a family in A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, complicates insofar as someone is killing the family. And the killer is confessing all as the show begins. Robert L. Friedman adapted the book from the novel and movie Kind Hearts and Coronets, the dark comedy of an illegitimate cousin who realizes he can have a title and prestige, money and love if he murders all of his relatives in the line of succession. Bryce Pinkham plays Monty, the wannabe lord, a fellow creepy but cheerful enough to be likable. Jefferson Mays plays all of the ladies and gentlemen that Monty cleverly plots to murder. And half the fun is watching Jefferson Mays morph from one victim to the next. The other half of the fun comes from the songs of composer Stephen Lutvak with lyrics of Robert L. Friedman, songs with catchy tunes and the antic effervescence of an English music hall. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder is playing on Broadway. I'm Michael Bourne. In December of the year 2000, the WBGO All-Stars put their stamp on a Christmas classic. Has it stood the test of time? We'll let you be the judge. Sit back and enjoy what's become our own holiday tradition on the WBGO Journal, A Jazzy Night Before Christmas.
which was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled down for a long winter's nap. When, out on the lawn, there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter, and away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below. When, what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
On Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then, in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof, as I drew in my hand and was turning around. Down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound.
He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard of his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf. And I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk and, laying his finger aside of his nose, giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, as he started to flee, "Merry Christmas to all from 88.3.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal, a production of WBGO News. I'm Andrew Meyer. The WBGO Journal is available as a podcast. You can download this program and catch up on past episodes on our website at wbgonews.org. Join us next Friday night at 7:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, happy holidays, and stay tuned to WBGO, 88.3 FM, and WBGO.org.